Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Deep Three episode. Today's guest is David Aldridge, who has been a journalist for many, many years, has worked with Turner Sports, ESPN, has a fellow American University alumni. David, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, Vlad, man. It really is a pleasure, man. It's good to talk to you after all these years, man. We missed you in D.C.
And I miss D.C., to be honest with you. I miss D.C. You know, it's been my second home. Part of why I transferred to America when I did, it was because D.C., you know, D.C. in general was, it just felt like my home, you know, my home away from home. And since we kind of jumped into this, I know a lot of people probably want to hear more about the professional side of things, but I really want to hear about your experience at American University. You were also a beat writer, right, for Georgetown basketball during that time, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. No, my first beat was Georgetown in 88. Yeah, it was the first job I had covering one team at the Post. Yeah.
Awesome. And how was that for you? That was your first job. You know, how was the transition for you to cover such? Also, you know, it's a pretty big program. It's known worldwide, honestly. You know, you see Georgetown, everybody knows it. Were you nervous going into the job? How was the preparation for, as a beat writer, for Georgetown basketball?
I was incredibly nervous. I mean, I was two years prior, I was the play-by-play voice of American University basketball team on the radio, right? And we're playing Georgetown at the Capitol Center, and we lose by 2 points, you know? And then 2 years later, I'm covering Georgetown, and they were the number 5 team in the country then, I think, or the number 10 team in the country. So, I mean, you know, you knew the program, the success that John Thompson had. And first of all, I can't believe I'm at the Washington Post, you know, first of all, working at that paper right out of school, and then to get an assignment to cover Georgetown at 23 or 24, whatever age I was at the time. I was barely older than the players, you know, so it was quite a challenge, man. I mean, I tried to do everything I could think of to get ready and you know, talk to other people who had covered the team before and read up on them. And obviously, they're a national program, and they were a D.C. program, so I knew a lot about them, of course, and knew a lot of the people already. But, it still doesn't prepare you for that first time you have to ask John, Big John, a question, you know, as a reporter, right? Like, you're covering the team, and you have to ask him something, you know, about his team, and you don't know how he's going to take it. Is he going to be mad at me? You know, like, you know, I'm a kid. I'm not, you know, I'm just starting. And it was quite intimidating. But you know what? I got through it. I covered the team the best that I could. They won a tournament game, which was fun to watch that. So that was my first NCAA tournament that I had ever covered. So it was, that part of it was great, and it was a lot of fun. And, it was a good team. It wasn't their best team. It wasn't one of their best teams, but it was a fun team. They had Charles Smith, who wound up playing for the Celtics for a few years, was their best player, the little point guard. He was tough and made some big shots for him. They had Perry McDonald was on that team. They had some good hard playing players, Dwayne Bryant and people like that. They didn't have any superstars. Mark Tillman was on that team too. It was a good team, but I covered the one team in that whole era that didn't have like a first round lottery pick center. Like I missed Ewing. Dikembe, I missed Alonzo Mourning. I even missed like Don Reed, who wound up getting drafted, at least, you know, in the NBA, right? So, and played in the NBA for a few years. So I didn't have any of those big quality big men, or even Othella Harrington, somebody like that. I think Ben Guillory was the center on the teams that I covered. So it was just a different kind of Georgetown team, but it was still fun to cover.
Absolutely. Did you feel like it was less pressure, you know, not having that you know, all-star on the team? Was that like a little bit less pressure on you covering the team?
Well,
or?
You know what? Probably in retrospect, yeah. I mean, at the time you don't think that way because you're thinking, well, it's Georgetown and it's John Thompson, so they're going to win 27, 28 games. They're going to go deep into the tournament no matter who's on the team, right? Because you just have that kind of belief system that he's going to figure out. And, you know, it was a good lesson to know that, no, even John Thompson needs great players to do better than the second round of the tournament, you know. So, but, yeah, no, it was certain, but it was still scary just because it was my first beat. You know, you don't want to mess it up. You want to cover the team fairly. You want to cover the team well. And the thing that was the most interesting thing about that team that year was that they got in a lot of fights. It was the most most pugilistically sound basketball team I've ever covered. They got into at least three or four fights that year. Two with Pittsburgh. They had a fight with Syracuse, I think. I mean, every other game they were getting into a brawl, and it was just kind of strange. But you know,
How do you cover that fairly?
It's hard. It's hard because, you know, you have to look at the tape 100 times to see, well, what did this guy do to this guy? Who instigated it? Who threw the first punch? You know, did guys come off the bench? You know, I mean, so you're literally spending hours looking at these tapes. You know, you tape the games. I taped every game because I want to watch the game afterward because it's hard when you're covering it. It's weird. Like, when you're covering a game, you don't really watch the game. You're just trying to keep track of who's ahead and what the score is and all that. So I would always go back afterwards and watch the game again just to see if there was anything I missed. So when you would go back and you look at these VHS tapes of these games, and you would have to slow the tape down. Well, it looks like he's hit him in the back. Is that an elbow or did he just shove him? You know what I mean? So it's just like... You're trying to dissect every movement that's going on, and it was weird. So, yeah, because you don't want to write something that's wrong. Like, you don't want to say, well, this guy started it if he didn't start it, you know? So you had to go back, and they didn't let what happened, what Georgetown would do, they wouldn't let the players talk after a game when they had a fight. You know what I mean? So it would just be John. And then John, of course, would say, well, I didn't see what happened. So now you're like, oh, my God.
How do you manage, you know, like beginning of a career as a beat writer, how do you manage such a big-time coach in, you know, delicate situations? Because I'm sure you have to build some kind of trust with a coach to be able to ask those tough questions, you know. Otherwise, they kind of just sweep them under the rug and, you know, give you one of those answers that don't really help you.
Yeah, no, it was tough because, you know, you want to, again, I had, you know, you feel like you really have a big responsibility. You're covering Georgetown University for the Washington Post, right? So you can't get beat on a story, and you have to cover them the way that they've been covered all those years where they were going to the Final Four every year and going to the championship game every year. You have to have that same standard of reporting, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I felt very, you know, I felt very, like, nervous again would be the word, but just like, you don't want to mess up, right? And so now you're dealing with John. And I had met John here and there over the years, but John doesn't know me. You know, I'm a kid. I'm this kid reporter at the Post. You know, so he doesn't know me. And, you know, you try to get to know people, but he's in the middle of his season. You know, he's locked in. You know how coaches get when the season starts, they're locked in. You know, they're thinking about next game, next opponent, you know, how do we win and all that sort of thing. And the million things that they have to think about. So he's not really trying to, you know, have a deep, meaningful conversation with me about his.
Exactly. The media is the last thing, you know.
Exactly. So you're trying to just do it, figure it out as you go along, you know. And, there was, like I said, it was fine. There were no major blow-ups that year. What I did learn about John was you had to go through sports information to get John on the phone. So if you wanted to talk to him about a story, you had to call Bill Shapland, who was their SID at the time, tell him that you wanted to talk to John. And here's my, you know, I'll be at the office waiting. And Bill would say, well, you know, he's at practice, and then he's going to look at film throughout the evening. So, you know, you give me your home number in case he doesn't call you until later. So you give him the home number. And so what I figured out about John was John liked to talk, but he didn't like to talk until very late at night.
Until he did all his homework.
He would watch film, and that's when he would unwind while he was watching the film. He would call people, you know, and then he'd call, you know, and that included reporters. So I'd be asleep at 2 o'clock in the morning and the phone would ring. And of course it would be like, can I cuss on this show? I don't know. Can I cuss on your podcast, man? But it would basically be like, what the bleep do you want? Bleep, bleep. he wouldn't say, you know, David, this is John Thompson. I'm returning your call. It would be like, you know, so John, but that was his way of saying hello, you know. So it was okay. He wasn't mad at me. He was just, that's just how he said hello. And so then he would talk. He would talk to you for 25 minutes about your story, about everything else going on in college basketball, you know, about life. That's when he would talk. And so that was really kind of cool to know that you could actually get John to be kind of let his guard down a little bit, but you just had to wait, you know, you just had to wait till 2 a.m. and that's when he would feel comfortable talking to you. And then, but of course, by then my story's already written. So, and he knew that's why he did it, you know, so that he knew that the story had already been written and it was already printed and, you know, he wasn't in it. So now it was too late, but now he could talk. So once you understand that that's how he operated, it was okay. Because now I get it. Now I understand that. Okay, so I'll just wait. I'll talk to him, and that will let me write my next story. You know what I mean? So that's how you had to kind of look forward instead of behind, you know? So, but it was an education, to be sure.
Oh, absolutely. And as I was thinking, you know, you said that kind of stuff. A lot of people, especially a lot of European coaches, look up to Greg Popovich, but in some way he feels like the same, you know, he feels very cold. But then I've heard from, even I have some friends that played for him, that he's kind of the opposite, you know, he's very open once you pass a certain gate, and he's very friendly, and he's going to talk about everything. But, you know, I think a lot of people, a lot of coaches see that, you know, those 1-2-word answers that he'll give you. And how is the preparation for something like that? Because to me, what it seems like is, if you ask a bad question, he'll give you a bad answer. If you ask a really good question, he's actually going to give you a very thoughtful answer.
Correct. I think that's, for the most part, Vlad, that's true. And what Pop would always say when, you know, what he would say when we would talk to him before the game, because the coaches talk to the broadcast crew that's doing the game that night. Both of the coaches will talk to the broadcast crew before the game, you know, to talk about how the team's doing, trends, if somebody's hurt, you know, who's going to play, who's not going to play, just to give you a little more insight into how that team is doing at that, going into that particular game. And so the thing that he would always say to us is, it's not that I don't like David, or I don't like Craig Singer, or I don't like Doris Burke. He just did not like the fact that he was required to stop coaching and talk in the middle of a game. That's what bothered him. It wasn't so much what we asked him, although sometimes that bothered him too, as I'll tell you in a second. But it was more the idea of, why do I have to do this interview in the middle of the game while I'm trying to win this game? You know, I'm trying to coach my team to win this game. And, you know, so that's what his problem was. It was more philosophical than it was against any particular thing that we did. But what he would also say is, if you're going to ask me a question, don't tell me what you think happened, because most of the time you're wrong. you know, if you want to just ask me what I think happened, I'll tell you. But don't say, hey, coach, it looks like your team did this, that, and the third, or looked like your team was trying to do this, because he's saying that's most of the time it's completely wrong. So I learned that if you just say, hey, coach, What was your impression of the quarter? What happened in that quarter? What did you see happening in that quarter? He would sometimes be short, but more often than not, he would give you at least a decent answer, right? Like, I'm just trying to get these two questions asked and get out of there. We're not going to go into detail on much of anything. But what I also learned with Pop is that you're exactly right. You have to cross a certain threshold with him. And if you do, and he respects you, he will open up and he will be more accommodating. I remember one time I asked him a question, and I hadn't even finished asking it yet. And he looked at me, gave me this look like, are you out of your mind? This is the dumbest question of all time. This is so stupid. He's staring at me, and it's on YouTube. You can go look at it. And he stares at me and he stares at me, and 5 seconds go by and 8 seconds go by. And I look at him and I go, you realize we are on national television and it's live, right? And I put the mic right back in his face and he starts laughing. So you just have to go back at him. And if he respects you, he'll give, and he gave me a very fine answer. It was fine, you know. So it was, but you have to understand that and know that with him and not be, I always tell people, you can't take it personally. You know, like if he gives you a one word answer, it doesn't mean he hates you. It's just how he feels that particular day, and just ask your two questions and move on, you know? So that's how I always took it with him. I never took it personally. And I agree with what your teammates have told you about him. He is actually one of the most engaging, intelligent, and, you know, really kind of charming people I've ever met, in terms of his candor, his honesty about himself, about the team, about everything. And it's just those 45 seconds he just doesn't really like to share with the world. So that's okay.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, you know, his friendship with Željko Obradović is very well known in Europe, who's known to be one of the very tough coaches of European basketball. And I cannot imagine myself or anybody trying to interview him before a timeout. He's very known for his, like, tirades right before timeouts where he goes off on players, very old school. So I can see that, you know, the fact that Popovich has to do an interview in the middle of the game would really bother him, because it kind of goes against his old school grain of, you know, how to approach the game of basketball. It makes it more, you know, entertainment than basketball, which is a huge debate in Europe about the NBA. You know, is it really entertainment? Is it basketball? Is it EuroLeague? Is it better than the NBA because it's less entertainment, you know, it's more basketball. It's always an ongoing debate. And say it, I'm like, you know what, actually, if I don't like basketball, I love college basketball. for me, that's like, if I'm going to watch really good basketball, it's like, you know, I'll turn on Villanova. I'm a big fan of Coach Wright and the way he plays basketball. I'm a big fan. You know, I talk to Coach Wilford every now and then at UVA. Mm-hmm. I believe they play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, people say, oh, like, that's so boring. I'm like, actually, it's not. If you watch him play, it's kind of, you know, poetry in action. It's like what they work on, and they put it like, you know, they put the product out there almost to perfection, almost to what Coach Bennett wants. You know, and it's hard to do that. You know, when you play the UNCs and Dukes of the world, and you play guys like Zion and RJ Barrett, and you come up with UVA and try to keep them under 40, 50 points. I mean, that's to me that's like poetry in motion. You know, like for basketball, for my type of basketball IQ. And what I love about basketball, the purity of it. So it's always that debate between Europe and, you know, and Popovich always seems to be the European guy in the NBA. You know, at least that's how a lot of people see them. A lot of people are, you know, San Antonio, a lot of basketball people are San Antonio Spurs fans in Europe because of Popovich and how he built that dynasty, you know. And it's very well known how it all started. You know, it didn't start that easy for him, or he was on the rocks, basically. So it's pretty amazing.
It's
amazing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he is, and you know, he's big. He obviously brought Messina over a couple of years ago to sit on the bench for a few years, and really loved the European style. And, you know, the Spurs really were the first team to kind of embrace the full-bodied embrace of international players, right? I mean, you know, they brought in Duncan, they brought in Ginobili, they brought in Umberto. You know, they just kept bringing people in from all over the world, and it really showed in how they played. It was, there was just so much more passing, and you know, Patty Mills from New Zealand and all, you know, all the different things that they've done over the years to really kind of incorporate ball movement has been really kind of, they were really kind of the vanguard. There were other teams that passed the ball. I'm not saying that they were the first team to do that, but the way they did it and the flow and the kind of four out, one in way they play, you know, that was new and innovative. And I think they did it. Even Dallas with Dirk, I mean, Dirk was a great player, but Dirk was essentially, you know, a mid-post player. Like, he was an elbow guy. That's where he did his work, was at the elbows, you know? It's like, I mean, he shot threes, but it wasn't where he did his work. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't his bread and butter. It was that elbow, right elbow jumper where he killed people coming off that street, right? So, so the Spurs really kind of were one of the vanguards of that kind of international style. And they were so good at it, and, you know, I think they really kind of showed other people the way to go with it. And then, you know, Houston kind of took it to the next level, and some of the other teams that they really made the three, the dominant shot. But if I always say, if Houston had Tim Duncan, they wouldn't do that. They did it because they didn't have Tim Duncan, right? So absolutely. You have Tim Duncan, you get him the ball. So yeah, but that's where I think Pop is and R.C. Buford in San Antonio are really kind of universally respected. I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, and to me, you mentioned Dirk, and, you know, like, myself, I tried to mold my game after Dirk. I remember watching, you know, highlights, especially that year when I transferred from Ace to American. I was big on watching highlights of Dirk, you know. I was talking to Coach Jones, and I was like, what do you expect of me? And he's like, you know, you got to carry this team. Like, you know, we have a lot of guys graduating. You got to carry this team. And for me, I think one of my biggest regrets in basketball, and I think Coach Jones knows that, the whole staff knows it, and is not being able to take that team to an NCAA tournament my last 2 years, because I feel like that's why I went, that's why I came to American University. You know, I was like, I wanted that role, and it was one of those things that, you know, for me, like, it was hard to, you know, to take in, because I just feel like I failed, you know, and everybody was like, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
It was, but
oh my God, no!
You cannot, you know, but you cannot shake it off. You cannot shake it off, and it's the same.
Yeah,
thing. When Dirk won the championship, I was so happy, because, it, in some ways, I just felt like relatable, that story. That you know, for so many years he couldn't do it, and then he did it. And it's just funny how life works, you know. And then I end up, you know, winning about four championships overseas, you know. So it's like, okay, it works out fine, but, you know, it's still always going to stink. You know, I think that's always, it's always going to stay with you, you know, when you end your career. And we can transition with this to the American University basketball part, where you end your career on basically a half-court buzzer beater at home in a double OT game. You know, so it's tough. You know, you see, you score a bucket on the other side, and you come back on defense, like 1 second, 2 seconds, and boom, the ball goes in from almost half court, and you end your college career. And you're a big fan of American University basketball. I don't know how many people know that overseas, and you've been very, very supportive. That's kind of how we initially met, and your support is truly amazing for the school, for the program, and, you know, especially for the basketball program. I think you've been a great advocate, and we thank you for that. You know, all of us that have been involved in that program, some ways you put us on the map. And I want to see, how did you become such a big, of course, it's the school you went to, but how did you become such a big American University fan? Like, was there a player maybe during the time that you were in school that really made you fall in love with, you know, American University basketball? Because even though you're a student there, I just know a lot of students when I was there that were like going to Georgetown games, you know, they're going to George Washington games, because the competition is better, let's face it. You know, you can't beat a big game for a 10 game with a Patriot League one.
Yeah. Well, it's complicated, Vlad. And it goes back, obviously, it goes back to when I went to AU, you know, as a student. And like I said, I did the play-by-play for the radio station the last 2 years. And then even before that, my first year there, I worked in the athletic department. I was in sports information. I had a work-study program there to kind of help pay tuition, right? So that was one of those jobs that I had. And so I worked with Terry Cornwell, who was the SID at the time, and we went to every men's game, we went to every women's game, you know, and did the stats and all that sort of thing. And so you just kind of you relate to guys and you relate to the women on the team. You know, like the women's teams when I was there, the women's teams were much better than the men's teams. So, you know, the players there, you got to know them a little bit. When I was there, the best men's player was Frank Ross, who wound up who's now with the Wizards. He's one of the assistant general manager there, but was a really great player. I think he's now fourth or fifth because Saeed pushed everybody down one. So I think Frank is now fifth all-time leading scorer in school history. And Frank was a really good player. I mean, he could score. I mean, he was a flat-out shooting guard who could put the ball in the basket and could get to the rim. And so they were never good. Like, they never got close to winning 20 games, but they were always competitive. You know, like I said, my senior year, we lost. We were tied with Georgetown with 30 seconds to go at Georgetown. So we played and we beat GW every year I was there. So we played the local teams very well and very competitively, even though our team wasn't all that good. And we were in the CAA at the time, so it was a higher level of competition. So, again, we played the Navy teams with David Robinson. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? That team that made made the Elite Eight, you know, we played that team, you know. So, and then, you know, we had played UNC Wilmington, which had a guy named Brian Rossum, who was a great big man, and some other teams that had good players. So I just – and that's when I was falling in love with basketball, you know, because it was just kind of the sport I was around more than any of the other sports, even though – the soccer team was really good, and they made the national championship game my junior year at AU. They were really good. But we didn't really see the soccer players other than at games. Like, they weren't really around campus, or at least I didn't see them on campus very much. But you saw the basketball players on campus a lot, and you saw them, you know, in classes and different things. And so you just got to know them a little bit better. I don't know. I just kind of gravitated toward basketball and enjoyed it. And then, so once that, you know, once I graduated and after I graduated, you know, I was kind of in and out, to be honest with you, because the quality of the teams kind of went up and down a little bit. We had some really lean years there. And then when Jeff got the job, you know, you could just tell right away that he knew what he was doing. I mean, he had coached, obviously, he had been at UVA as a coach, so he knew. He had been in a Final Four as a player, so, I mean, you knew that this guy knew what he was doing. And so the team just got better. You know, you could just tell immediately they were better coached, better prepared, you know, like, and they started winning, you know, and we started making it. And once we got to the Patriot League, we started making the championship games, and then we just couldn't win one. We got to four championship games in 6 years and lost all of them. it was devastating. Yeah. It was just devastating. And so now, you know, and we were one of the last Division I programs that had never been to the NCAA tournament. You know, I think there's only five now, and we were like eight, right? So, so you know, there was only eight schools at the time. So when we finally broke through and won in 2008, it was just the you know, it was just so much emotion. And I remember Jeff, they showed the picture of Jeff on the sidelines at the final buzzer, you know, crying into a towel, right? Because he understood what it meant to everybody, not only the players on the team and the students, but the alumni, you know, because we had been banging our heads against the wall for 30 years, some people for 50 years, trying to get to the tournament. And so it just meant so much to us. And so that explains why I just love it. It's just, I just have so many great memories of the friendships that grew out of, you know, covering those teams, becoming friends with guys like Eddie Tapscott and Chris Nockey that coached the teams back when I was there. And then, you know, finally seeing the breakthrough and continuing on through now with Coach Brennan. It's just all the same thing. It's just the small, it's just the community. It's our little community of people that really just, we just love the idea that we have a chance to make the tournament. You know what I mean?
It's so hard to understand, you know, sometimes because from the outside, it looks very different. That's the same thing that I felt there, you know, I felt like it was like a family environment, you know, when you go to a big school, it's very different, or even like a George Mason type school, the support is different. There's support there. Don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. But once you come to like a school like American University, it's there's no support, it's family, you know. It's like you can lean on somebody, yeah. And it's there, you know. Athena, who just retired, her and I, we just talked every few years, I would say. And last time when I signed in Greece, right away she wrote me a message, you know. We're talking about, this was, I was 8-9 years out of college.
Yeah.
And she saw I signed in Greece, and she sent me a message, you know.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, congrats, you're going back to Greece. So it was just such a great feeling, you know. Coach Jones and I, again, mm-hmm. we always kept in touch. I always talk to coaches there now. And, you know, it's a family type feeling. And that's why I feel like it was so hard for me to get over those losses my last 2 years, because, mm-hmm. you know, you're in a family situation. You kind of like let down family, you know, because you sign up for that role. It was not like, is the role I wanted? It just sometimes it doesn't work out. But that's one thing I got from American University. It's always been like a family type situation. And I think you described that best, you know, how people were waiting for 40, 50 years to get the NCAA tournament and finally came through. Yeah. And Coach Jones did a fabulous, you know, Coach Jones did a fabulous job there. You know, he wasn't the easiest coach in the players, I tell you that.
No. I've heard.
You know, he's not, but I think he builds you. And if you look at the track record, right, so at American University, even there, you had pro players coming out, you know.
Right.
And now at ODU, he even has even more. So that speaks a ton about him and his quality of coaching. And even as a human being, honestly, because when I was coming out, and it was such an iffy situation with the draft that year, it was a lockout year. He was always trying to help me out. He was always calling Coach Carlisle with the Mavs, like, see how he can help me out. And then there was no summer league. There was nothing, so he couldn't really help me out anymore. Right. But he really tried everything, and I really appreciate that for him. Or when I was meeting agents, you know, when he was giving me his input. Or he was like, okay, let's meet in my office so these guys don't trick you. Whatever it is that you don't know the situation, he's there to help you at the end of the day. It's not like, okay, I'm coaching you hard, but I really care about you off the court. And I think that kind of spread about JJ around the program too. Like, he just cared about the people that were there, and, you know, he cared to make that program successful.
Yeah.
And now,
no question.
One last thing that I want to talk to you about.
Yeah,
you were going to give me the top three players that you ever seen live, as far as just basketball. What would that top three be, VA?
The top three that I've ever seen live. Okay. Well, I would say Jordan is one.
So I don't have to start that debate right there. Good.
No. I mean, I say this all the time, and some people get mad at me. And when I say I don't think it's even especially close, you know, like, I mean, to me, Jordan is so much better than anybody I've seen since. And I say that with all due respect to Kobe and LeBron, who are both great players, you know, top 10 level players. But Jordan was just different. It was just something different about him. I can't explain it. It has to do with his will. He didn't just want to win. He wanted to dominate. He wanted to destroy people. He wanted to humiliate people. And I mean that in the most complimentary way.
It is. As a competitor, like from a competition standpoint, that's
you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I absolutely know. Exactly. Like,
And he was the most ruthless at that anybody I've ever seen. His will was so strong. And once they started winning, I mean, they were unbeatable. And I think it always comes back to him. He just would not let them lose. I've always said to many people that I saw lots of games where Jordan was 7-22 from the floor. You know, there were lots of games where he didn't have a shot. He just couldn't make a shot that night. But he still impacted the game somehow. You know, he would get three steals that night, or he would get three blocks that night, you know, or he would do something else, get 9 rebounds. He'd do something else to impact the game, even if he wasn't scoring at a high level. So he was just the most amazing competitor I've ever seen. He just was off the charts in terms of his competitive nature. And the proof was in the championships that they won. The fact that he never had to play a game seven in six finals.
That's
he never played
it.
A game yeah. seven.
He never let it get. He never let it get there. You know, like
right. Didn't need one. Yeah. So yeah. That's. I mean, that tells you all you need to know. To me, so I would say he's one. Two is tough because there's so many guys you could pick. You could pick LeBron. Yeah. You could pick Kobe. You could pick Duncan. Duncan was great. People understand.
Well, five favorite,
Duncan
absolutely.
Was. Yeah, how great a player Tim Duncan was.
Well, I think a lot of people watched him towards the end of his career, and then if you go back to you know those younger years of Tim Duncan, he was you know, very different. He wasn't this five man all utility type guy. He was really he was a dominant force. But he's played so long over such a period of time. It's kind of the same that like with Vince Carter. People kind of got used to the last 5-6 years of Vince Carter where. No, like we're talking about Canada. It's different. Like he was, he was.
Y'all don't remember how good he was. Y'all don't know how good he really was.
Yeah, you know, it's just different because I don't know if it's kids or younger reporters or whatever it is nowadays. Especially with social media, everybody has an opinion, and it's like here, it's like, oh, why did they keep Vince Carter in the league? Why did he do this? And I'm like, this is like you guys just caught him like at 40-something years old.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
When some people are long retired, you know, the same thing with Duncan. And,
Exactly.
True,
hard to kind of, and see, when I first came into the league, that's when I saw Magic and Bird play, but they were both toward the end, you know, so I didn't see them in their primes. I mean, I saw them, but I wasn't covering the league then. You know, I was at AU then, you know, when they were in their primes. But by the time I started covering the league for the Post, they were both on the downhill part of their career. So, I could say Magic, but I didn't see Magic at his best, which is what I think you're getting at. He was still really good, but he wasn't great any, all time great anymore. So I would say Jordan.
It's a toss up after that. I totally agree with
you.
Tough. I think it's
tough.
It's the same that I would put. Yeah. You know, if it was like, oh, well, what's yours? You know, it's like it'd be. And for me, it would be Jordan. You know, how I got to watch Jordan, you know, my uncle. He has a similar position to yours as far as, like, you know, he's a journalist. He was a sideline reporter for some of the Romanian soccer teams, you know, TV anchoring, all this stuff. And he's writing a book about Jordan, Romanian. He's been writing for about 10 years now, you know. So he's trying to come out with it in the next year or so. And then he always tells me stories that I didn't know about Jordan. And that always fascinates me because – or I would read something and, like, share it with him. It just – You know, I was so young back then, you know, born 88. But still, you wake up at like, you know, 5-6 years old, and you wake up at 4 a.m., whatever, and you turn the TV on, and all you see is the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah,
and you see this guy, and he's just so different. And it was so hard to, you know, like you said, you know, and I loved Kobe for most part, and it was just, it's just Jordan, you know, it's like he, without Jordan, it would be. No Kobe, you know, or like,
right?
And LeBron is a whole different breed too, and they're all so great. But like you said, you know, for me, from a basketball player standpoint, as far as like the competitive nature and like never letting things get ugly for him, that to me, that's like it says it all. It's like he was such a killer that you have to put number one, at least in my book too. You know, that's why. So kind of happy you said that.
I obviously with the Last Dance show that was on a couple months ago, everybody's talking about Jordan again, and people, I've done a lot of interviews with people who said LeBron or Jordan, and I'm like, guys, this really isn't a debate. It really isn't a debate here. As good as LeBron is, and he's terrific, he's great, you know. There's no debate here. You guys think this is an argument. It really isn't. I mean, you know, there's Jordan and then there's everybody else, you know. So, I probably have those three, Jordan, Kobe, LeBron, probably in that order, with Duncan, like, really close to LeBron even, you know, neck and neck with LeBron. But I'll give LeBron his props because, you know, he's done it for a very long time. With a lot of attention on him, and he's been great. He's been great for most of his career. So, I'm not, you know, not giving him his props, because he is one of the greatest players of all time, no question.
Absolutely. Well, D.A., thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. It's been great talking to you, great catching up, and I hope we stay in touch going forward.
Glad, man. It's such a pleasure. Let me just say this before we go, man. I mean, I want you to know, and I take to heart what you said about how you feel about your years at AU. But believe me when I tell you, man, we loved you. We loved having you. You were great. You were the only reason we were in those games to begin with, and we all understand that. We get that, and I don't know of a single person that saw you play for us that would say anything other than, that dude was awesome, and we were lucky to have him for 2 years, So please believe me when I tell you the AU people love you, and, anytime you're back on, back in town, let me know, because, we really appreciate, what you did for us for those 2 years. It was fun watching you. Those battles you had with C.J. McCollum, I still talk to people about all the time. I tell people, you know what? C.J. may be in the NBA, but I saw a dude give him 40, all right? So don't get it twisted now. like you said, if there hadn't been a lockout that year, I think things may have turned out way different, it's just the way it is. It is what it is. But, man, just thank you for what you did for us, and continued success and safe travels, man, as you, continue about in this world with what we're all dealing with right now. Just try to stay safe, man.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate it. My dream is, after my playing career, is part of, to help someone, American University in the program. And, we'll see how that works out, in the future. Because like I said, to me it was family, and, it was also family that took me in at a time that I was struggling very much in my dreams of becoming a professional basketball player at a very high level, and somebody that really, recruited me coming out of high school. Coach Donahue recruited me, but I thought, probably like any other kid, you think you're better than, sometimes you really want to go to a higher level school and stuff like that. And then you don't realize it's all about the fit. It's all about, how you feel in the system on and off the court, what the coaches do to help you progress. And, they were really the first ones to call me as soon as they found that I'm transferring. And, I had options. I was thinking about going to NC State, Denver, Boston. To go to another tough conference. And as soon as, KD called me, and it was the next day I went to campus too. I was like, okay, I'm driving. We'll see you guys the very next day. They were playing Brown. I love what I saw. And oh, you don't want to go visit. I was like, I'm not visiting anybody else. That's it. I saw American. I saw the coaches there. We spoke, and I'm done. Coach Love at NC State, he's like, come on, I have Brendan Carver. He's graduating. You and J.J. Hickson. I was like, I've been to that before. It's a feeling type thing for me always.
Yeah.
And that feeling is like, okay, this is a place for me. These are the people that really wanted me here. And like I said, it's a family experience in America, and I'm very thankful to have experienced it. But yeah, thank you very much again. And we'll certainly stay in touch.
Man, my pleasure. Stay safe, man. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.